an Audi original.
Hello, and thank you everyone for joining us for this panel about the Smokescreen podcast, which many of us on this panel have been working on for quite some time now. I'm James Bull. I'm the global editor of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. I'm very pleased to be joined by some of the Smokescreen team. Victoria Hollingsworth, who is a freelance investigative journalist and will be a very familiar voice to many of you. Chrissy Giles, who is the editor of the Smokescreen and Bureau's Global Health Project, and Tom Wright of Novel, who produced the podcast. I'm also very pleased to be joined by BizNews' Alec Hogg, who has done a weekly segment on the podcast on his show each week. It's been quite an undertaking to do this story. It's hundreds of thousands of documents. It's been parts of this story have been told several times before, but sort of the whole beginning to end narrative and some of the twists along the way were very much new. Victoria, you were sort of on this project for the longest. What kind of drew you to this story and made you think there was more to be told?
Oh my gosh, where do I begin? I think actually I started looking at this topic, and then I remember calling a friend who Richard Cookson, who turns out had done the British American Tobacco investigation for Panorama previously, said, "Oh, I'm kind of looking at this, and what do you think?" And he's like, "Well, I'm looking at this as well." And so we both started thinking, well, maybe there's something really here that hasn't been uncovered before. And so I came to you, James, and I was like, I think within these leaked documents, I think it was the trigger was these leaked documents that had been put on Twitter anonymously initially. And so we started sort of digging through those and reading around it and realizing that a lot had been covered about these leaks, but really in a, hey, there's some leaks that have just appeared online, and you know, an article here or there, but nobody had really got them all together and really started to go through them. And what really interested me and why I brought it to you was nobody had really picked up on the UK angle and the fact that a lot of these a lot of the documentation was relating to it'd been sort of sanctioned from the UK head office, you know, apparently so. So it's like, well, hang on, no one's really focused on this UK aspect, and that's, you know, so relevant to us. The fact that all these activities were driven from the UK. So that was really what got me very interested, because that hadn't been looked at before. So yeah, that's why I thought, I think there's going to be something here if we just keep on digging.
And that's sort of the classic thing with any kind of corporate scandal, isn't it? People try and fix it to, oh, well, it's a few bad apples, or it was just in that country. And, you know, a lot of what happened in South Africa with Belinda, with the network of spies, with that sort of thing, was quite well known. But as you say, this did go right back to BAT head office. And, you know, for people who might not have got all the way through the podcast, gasp, or sort of coming to it from here, you know, what was the sort of, how easily did it trace it back to the UK? Was it sort of one email one time, or was there more?
Yeah, well, that was the thing, because I think the way it had been reported on in South Africa was often through this sort of dramatic lens of this femme fatale character, this Belinda spy, and also very much focused around the relationship that she had with Johan van Lochenberg, who was, you know, running the investigation into the tobacco industry at the time, and the huge controversy around that and the dramatic implications on the loss of revenue to South Africa as a country. You know, huge story and massive importance. But I was interested in, the reason Belinda was so pivotal to us and our investigation beyond what was happening in South Africa was because, you know, that very first meeting that she had with BAT was with somebody from the UK. They met together, and he discussed you know, how they were going to have this relationship, how they were going to pay her in this, you know, fairly unorthodox way of untraceable, allegedly untraceable Travelex cards, which, you know, it's pretty unusual way to get information in a you know, open way. So it was like, this seems a bit odd. And why the UK flying to South Africa and paying this central figure in these Travelex cards? So, you know, the link to the UK was not exactly like a rabbit warren of links. It was pretty direct. You know, they weren't although they had this separate private security company, which we can get onto in a moment, it was this sort of link between this central figure, Belinda, and these really senior figures in the UK head office. And I was just like totally intrigued by that relationship and what on earth they were getting out of that. And when we started to gather the documentation together, it was just phenomenal. Like, we weren't having to make assumptions around this, because we actually had the emails, we had, you know, the messages, we had, you know, it was very, UK head office couldn't deny that this relationship existed, you know, they'd even written a letter confirming all the payments that they'd made to her. So it was pretty wonderful, really, to have all of this evidence fairly early on into our investigation, to go, oh, there's the direct link to the UK and very high up in BAT. So, you know, as I say, we're really onto something here. And nobody had really looked at it from that perspective, like, okay, who is sending these emails? Who's paying in these Travelex cards? So yeah, it was, you know, the UK link was really obvious from early on.
So there was sort of an unusual problem with this investigation as well, in that we almost sort of found ourselves with too many troves of documents and too much to look at, didn't we? Like, it yes. didn't really end with these Twitter documents. There was just sort of, you know, one source, then another source, then another yeah. source, kind of go, hey, yeah. here's some things.
I remember coming to you being like, somebody else has just promised some documents, and I think, you know, somebody's going to send this thing, you know, and it was, we were getting them from lots of different areas, which is fantastic and brilliant for cross-referencing. But it was a bit like, originally, nobody wanted to speak, and it was quite difficult to get anybody to go on the record with us. And then it was like, okay, I'm going to share something with you. And I'm like, okay, maybe a couple of documents. Oh, I can't go through this. It's thousands. Absolutely. I mean, like, hundreds of thousands of documents, which is really unusual and also fairly impossible to go through. So I remember, I think at the time I was gathering all these documents together, I had watched this film Dark Water, which is about, like, investigating, you know, corrupt practices, and he opens this door to the room where all his evidence is, and is literally a large room full of boxes, like, just filling the room. And I just thought, oh my god, that's basically what we've got, but it's all, like, in a impossible, you know, we managed to get it in a searchable database in the end, which was just really wonderful and helped to cipher, you know, to go through them all. But, you know, if we'd have actually printed out every single bit of documentation we had, it would have definitely filled a huge room. So fairly overwhelming at the beginning. I mean, and throughout, to be fair.
All looked like we had some kind of issue with hoarding, I think, wouldn't we? It might be healthy. Let's do a little plug for our friends at the University of Bath there, who were the ones who helped us out with the search database. But yes, essentially we've got to this point where we knew a lot and we had a lot of documents, and then Tom, this is more or less when we dropped everything in your lap. How do you go about sort of changing something with a little bit of audio but not very much and endless reams of documentation into a podcast someone might listen to?
Well, I think the very first hurdle was just understanding everything, because you guys were coming to it with a huge amount of knowledge already, having already been sifting through these documents and already being sort of knee deep into the story. And I arrived with sort of zero prior knowledge of this story. So Malcolm Rees was enormously helpful in very patiently and over a very long time explaining and then re-explaining it to me. And then once we'd got our heads around that, the really key thing was finding people who are willing to talk to us. Because the problem with a podcast about documents is that documents can't speak. So that then began a really long search to find people who were willing to go on the record and were willing to share their stories. And that was tricky. It really seemed like the South African tobacco scene was not a space where people were prepared to talk lightly. So that's why we were really grateful for those who did and were willing to go on the record and share their stories with us. So I think the really key thing for making the podcast was to understand the evidence base of what we were working with, and then to understand the stories of the characters we were speaking to and the stories that they were telling us, and how to make that work over 8 episodes.
So it must have been a bit of a overfacing sort of first day where you got assigned to this project by Novel, and then just sort of get a huge barrage about kind of, you know, how South African private investigators operate, how British American Tobacco works, cooperation with law enforcement, the role of JVL as the regulator and Belinda as quite a central character. Did you sort of, you know, find yourself going home and thinking, what on earth have I got into here?
Well, I think, you know, even at in the simplest version of just Belinda's story, it's an incredibly complicated thing to try and get your head around. The fact that somebody could be working for a group of tobacco manufacturers and actually secretly working for their rivals in a relationship that was facilitated by the state intelligence agency. I mean, just as a sentence, that's a big one to try and get your head around. And so what I really tried to do was break it out into blocks. So I would try to think about Belinda's story and about how the kind of chronology of that, and also the different bits of material we had sort of laying out her story. I think, you know, a really, really key document was the draft affidavit that she didn't sign. But that was a really key document, I think, for kind of understanding her perspective and her side of the story, and then cross-referencing that against what are our interviewees who sort of intersect with her stories at various different points were telling us about what had happened. So I think the really key thing was breaking it down into more digestible chunks. So focusing on Belinda, and then focusing on Francois and the FSS relationship, and then finally the Zimbabwe story, which I think really was the twist in the tale that none of us saw coming.
Do you want to say a bit about what the Zimbabwe story is and sort of how we came across it? Because it wasn't something we particularly looked for, was it?
No, I mean, the way that we found that story is amazing. And the journalist who found it is a journalist called Alan Avram, who works with the University of Bath. And he was the one who came across it. But to back up for a moment, what the story is that FSS, who was the private security firm that British American Tobacco contracted and acted as their kind of boots on the ground operation in South Africa, had started to expand their operation into Zimbabwe. And in so doing, they had fallen foul of the Mugabe regime, and two of their contracted agents had ended up being arrested on what appeared to be trumped up charges and thrown in jail. A meeting was then organized with representatives of the Mugabe regime and FSS, and a donation was put on the table of up to $500,000. We don't know if the money was paid, but we do know that shortly after the offer was put on the table, the agents were freed and FSS were allowed to continue operating in Zimbabwe. And the way that we came across this story is incredible, because it was Alon at the University of Bath who found it. And it was a document that someone at FSS had accidentally attached to the wrong email. So they'd meant to attach a different document about something completely unrelated, and they'd accidentally attached a debriefing document that basically laid out the entire scheme. And I think Victoria, you were present at the meeting when Alan kind of revealed this to the team.
Yeah, so there's a number of us working on this. I hope you can see me all right, because everyone's gone a bit fuzzy. I'm not sure if it's my internet or am I still moving and not sounding like a robot?
Can see you fine.
Okay, fine. So what was wonderful about working on this was that it was the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the University of Bath and Panorama, BBC Panorama, and we would have regular meetings and updates on how we were going, how we were getting on with our research and who we'd spoken to and where we were at with things. And I remember Alan called a sort of a special meeting. And he said, I think I found something a bit interesting. And we were listening and he said, yeah, I found this debriefing document. And he started to tell us about it. And, you know, literally we were like, what? You know, our fate, all our sort of mouths hit the floor. It sounds remarkably like that's negotiating an enormous sum of money through FSS to the Mugabe regime, to ZANU-PF. Like, I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe that this was even being discussed, that this could be on the cards. It was a really pretty, you know, super exciting part of the investigation. But it really floored all of us. We, you know, talk about needle in a haystack. It really did feel that was quite an incredible find. So, you know, when you're going through hundreds of thousands of documents and you come across something like that and it's talking about, you know, maybe you could consider a donation in the region of $300,000 to $500,000 to ZANU-PF, it sort of totally blows your mind, you know, because I'm like rifling through, oh, sounds like a bribe payment of a couple of hundred, you know, 60,000 rand here and there. And suddenly this up to $500,000 like was a whole different ball game. It was a very exciting find.
So should give some credit to absent colleague Matt Chapman, who did quite a lot of work chasing down that very, very good initial find from Alan, which may be a sort of email fail for the ages. But Alec, I'd like to bring you in here. Some sort of parts of the core of this story have been quite familiar inside South Africa for some time, you know, what we've built out from and sort of taken on. How has it been to sort of see an international perspective and international interest on this tale and on sort of the way multinationals are operating in South Africa?
You did it the right way. The way that Victoria targeted BAT, which is one of the top five listed companies on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which means most South Africans have got are co-owners of the company when you take it down to its basis. A basic era. Also, they're the dominant, have been for many years, the dominant tobacco player in this market, and associated with the richest man in the country, Johann Rupert. So there's a lot of interest in South Africa. But the whole investigation here was contaminated a great deal by a lot of fake news that was published in the biggest newspaper over a period of some weeks, attacking Johan van Lochrenberg. Literally, you had fake news on the front page of the biggest newspaper saying the SARS team, van Lochrenberg and his team, were running a brothel. And then the next week, there'd be something else along the fake news aspect. And I think Malcolm Rees will admit that he was played really badly during this period. And of course, it's almost like the story then became contaminated and people wondered what was true and what was false. But the real attack is the angle that you followed was the right angle, which was to go and have a look at the legitimate side of it. You know, Victoria, you think this is, and it is unusual when you're sitting in the UK, because UK companies, like American companies, if they bribe anyone anywhere in the world, you go to jail. In South Africa, it's kind of everyday living, unfortunately. We do have a president who's trying to sort it out now, but his political party has paid very heavily for the anti-corruption campaign, because there are lots of people inside who rely on being paid handouts. For instance, just just to understand the context of this, in South Africa we have a system of government where you vote for a political party rather than an individual. In local elections are different, but usually. And so to get onto the list of the political party who gets sent to parliament is quite a big deal. And people kill each other. There's 12, 15 people are murdered, different participants on the list. So it's a very different world that we operate in to the first world. However, this story, and it was a bit like what happened in South Africa with the Zuma era, with those noxious individuals, the Guptas, who were behind state capture, it only broke when the international community took an interest. It only broke when Bell Pottinger, one of, in fact, the biggest communications company at one point in London, was forced to close over what it had done. And it only broke when someone like Peter Hain stood up in the House of Lords and made it an issue. So what you've done is to be celebrated here in South Africa, because a lot of things will happen here as just normal everyday issues. But when they get exposed to a global environment, and being a developing country, you need money to come in. You need investment capital. And when the foreign investors say, "Whoa, hang on a minute, we're not going to touch this place," or when you have a big multinational that's taking advantage of the poor governance in the country, and that multinational is exposed, it makes a massive impact. So you've done a wonderful piece of work and made a huge contribution to this country, and it's hitting in the right channels, that's for sure.
So that's great to hear, Alec. I had actually been going to mention Bell Pottinger myself, so I'm glad that you did. In that it did sort of make me wonder, this sort of scandal happening, you know, over a lot of the same period as some of Bell Pottinger's activities in South Africa. What is it with UK-based or UK co-based multinationals sort of getting involved in some very questionable aspects of either South African politics or South African commerce? You know, so what, you know, what's London's problem?
Yeah, what's London's problem? Bell Pottinger, at the time that they were in full cry, gave a legal firm in London called Schindler's, I'm sure you know all about them, £100,000 to kill BizNews, to kill our business. And essentially they saw us as, well, if we can close this business down, then everybody else who has been investigating what the Guptas were up to, and it was heinous, the crimes that were being committed, they would then close us down or at least scare us off, then everybody else would be scared off as well. And that's a real London kind of tactic. Play in developing markets where the pound is mighty and the locals are very weak, relatively speaking. But I think that they found that South Africans were equal to the task. And of course, there's no more Bell Pottinger. So that kind of tells a story all of its own. But BAT is still very, very operative here in the country. There's been no apologies that I've seen. It was clearly, its hands were mucky. As we've heard on Smokescreen and all the work that you've done, the interview I did in London, it seems people are freer, South Africans are freer to talk in London with Yusuf Kaji, made all kinds of allegations. And at the time, I cut that interview down because I thought I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in court. And now I'm looking at it again and thinking, hang on, maybe Yusuf had a point. Look, Yusuf himself is, as you had in Smokescreen, he's got a lot to answer for. He's an admitted smuggler and he did all kinds of funny things. But what he was saying about BAT there as well was maybe a lot closer to the truth than we think. Some of this stuff is just fantastic when exactly as you uncovered with ZANU-PF and that $500,000 bribe. And it is a bribe and it happens every day, but no one gets found out. In Angola at the moment, the richest woman in Africa, Dos Santos's daughter, has been found out. And the more that we get, because it's only investigative journalists who do this work, opening up these avenues, the better the world will be.
Very hopeful note. On the topic of consequences, I'm going to come back to you, Victoria, before I bring Chrissy in. In that, you know, if BAT is still operating and very dominant in South Africa, it's also still doing very well in the UK. And BAT's own line is that it's done nothing wrong and all of its activities were about stopping smuggling. And one of the lines it sort of used to us to emphasize was that the SFO had not launched a prosecution on it, which BAT framed as a total exoneration. Do you think BAT was totally exonerated by a very thorough SFO investigation? Or is the picture, as I might be hinting, a little bit more complicated than that?
I think it's the latter, yeah. I think, yes, in our final episode, which, you know, Tom's done a marvellous job of putting our thoughts in some sort of coherent structure on this, because the... You know, we'd sent a freedom of information request and into the Serious Fraud Office and found that I think they had 7 people working on this investigation, which does not strike me as very many. And I can pretty much imagine that BAT's law firm had substantially more people than that working on it too. We know, I mean, the problem in a lot of this is, you know, it kind of what Alec was just saying about, oh, maybe I should revisit what Yusuf Kharji had said. And then you have to counter that straight away with, oh, but he maybe a self-confessed smuggler and he's sort of got his hands dirty in other ways. Is that a lot of these people with this substantial evidence may not be the most upstanding citizens in a court of law. And maybe the SFO felt that this, some of the evidence that they had seen would be picked apart by some very expensive law firm employed by BAT, and that their chances of winning were not great. However, we know from at least two or more, I mean, the people that eventually did speak to us and hand over significant bits of evidence have said they, the SFO have not seen this. So we absolutely know there's evidence that they've not considered. And we think that it definitely needs to be examined and that they need to look at this evidence in the whole, as we have tried to do, and then make a call on it. They closed it because they felt the evidential bar was not reached for a successful prosecution on the Bribery Act. But as I say, we feel there is more evidence that they didn't consider. So by the end of the podcast, and certainly, like, I am just chomping at the bit for them to reopen this or to you know, what's been so really exciting is that questions have been raised in our parliament in the UK about this, questioning the SFO. Are they going to reopen this? You know, Lord Hayne has spoken out about this. That, you know, I feel very excited that this isn't just a piece of journalism that we've put out there, that this is being picked up. Like, we've handed the baton over now. We've done what we can do as journalists. And I really, really hope that now it has got to the attention of some members of parliament in the UK that they're going to continue to raise this with the SFO and that eventually this investigation will be reopened. I mean, you know, that would be the ultimate, really.
So it really did strike me, I think, particularly watching the BBC Panorama, where there was this little succession of people who had been willing to speak on record, on camera, and often had given documents. And you know, they were asked, you know, did you speak to the SFO? No. Would you speak to the SFO? Yes. And so far as we know, there's still been nothing, which is pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
It is, because the people that are willing to put their heads above the line on this deserve to be listened to. You know, we featured Francois van der Westhuizen in our podcast, incredibly brave person to have spoken out like he has. His life is greatly at risk for having done so, and he's had to flee South Africa. But I totally commend him for being completely honest and open with us, sharing the documentation and being very, very willing to share all of that with the SFO. And I really hope they pick him up on that offer. And the same with Johan van Lochenberg. He's gathered a lot of evidence. I mean, they aren't the only two. There are a lot of people and people that didn't want to speak on the podcast, but would be willing to speak with the authorities. I do believe, you know, I feel like we were... there's more to the story than even we were able to broadcast that deserves to be looked at by the authorities in the UK.
It is in some way a bigger ask to ask someone to broadcast to the world the allegations they're making rather than sort of in the privacy of directing the SFO, isn't it? It's just how it is.
And there's also the risk to life. You know, the number of conversations, incredible, open, frank conversations I had with people that then said, but you can't use a word of this. You cannot say, you cannot repeat anything I've told you publicly because I don't want to be looking over my shoulder for the rest of my life. And that is a very, very real threat to all of these people. And for me, sitting in the UK, doing this investigation, saying, oh, but, you know, this is going to be really integral to our investigation if we can just get you to... And it's like, no, you cannot push anybody to go on. I mean, you would never push anyone to go on the record, but, you know, there's just no... I was really very early on totally respectful of anyone that would talk to me off the record. And then if they went even further to say they would agree to be interviewed was, you know, wow, that's, you know, I really was in awe of people that were willing to do that. So I just want to thank anyone that did speak to us.
So, yeah, there were quite a lot of brave people on this one. Chrissy, I'd like to bring you in half an hour in. Hi. sort of. Doing a tobacco investigation didn't come from nowhere for the Bureau, did it? We've been looking into big tobacco for a while. Sort of what's behind that and what's the broader sort of interest TBIJ has in big tobacco?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you have to have been living under a rock to not realise that, you know, cigarettes, tobacco, nicotine, all of these products are still massively responsible for, you know, huge amounts of illness, death, disability around the world. And I think, you know, in some countries you can look at the smoking stats in Britain and see that, you know, in the 60s half of everybody smoked, so one in two people walking down the street would be smoking. And today that's much lower, in the kind of mid-teens, but you know, that's not the case around the world. And also there's a lot of questions around who is smoking and why. And also smoking now can encompass a vast majority of things. It's not just tobacco. You know, you think about these companies and you go onto their websites or you'll look on their social media and they'll tell you, oh, look, we're not interested in getting new people to smoke. We're not looking after our interest in getting young people hooked. What we're really trying to do is help adult smokers get off of tobacco. We don't want people to smoke cigarettes anymore. And you're like, that's so great. And then you're like, hang on, your business is selling tobacco to people. So I think what's very interesting is like what is behind this idea that big tobacco are kind of writing themselves out of a job? Because obviously they're not. These are huge businesses with massive turnovers. They're operating in all parts of the world, particularly where labour is cheap. Perhaps regulation is more friendly towards them. Perhaps where there's a willing market of people where you can still buy a single cigarette, or you might advertise tobacco products outside of schools. So I think partly what we're interested in and have been interested in and continue to be interested in is what is the real future for big tobacco? Now, recently, you know, this year we see one of the big companies acquiring a pharmaceutical company, especially one that makes inhalers. And you're like, oh, hang on, this is like the circle of life. You know, you create products that cause massive illness and death, and then you also happen to own the company that provides the medical devices to treat them. And that's very interesting. There's also, you know, lots of next generation products, so things like vapes, heated tobacco. We see companies moving in a similar way, actually, to, I think, how the big breweries and the big alcohol companies have bought up lots of craft beer producers. You see these big tobacco companies now moving into sectors such as tobacco, such as cannabis, and also non-tobacco based products. So maybe they contain nicotine, maybe they don't even contain nicotine. Things like these vapes and e-cigarettes, there's loads of flavors, there's loads of different devices, you can get mods, you can make them how you want them. It's a massive, massive market. So partly what we're interested in is, okay, maybe we take on face value, which we never would, the idea that you're trying to move out of combustible cigarettes. So what about these next generation products? What about these pharma acquisitions? What about cannabis? What are you doing with these products? Are they really to help adult smokers stop smoking? And then what? Also, we're interested in things around, obviously, regulation and government involvement. So everything from advertising to tax incentives for these products and these companies. We're also wondering about, if you are advertising these products to existing adult smokers, then why, you know, are they appearing outside schools? Or why are you so invested in TikTok? Or why are you sponsoring this event for young people in Spain or Italy? It makes us sound very suspicious. And to be honest, we are. So I think it's something we're very interested in looking into. And we're also interested in the kind of legacy of these companies in terms of their past. So many tobacco companies obviously have roots in slavery and across the world, kind of indentured labour. So I think we're very interested in that legacy and also how it exists today and how those perhaps discriminatory roots are really still kind of expressed today. So we're interested in kind of makeup of these companies and who's doing the work, and also what is the kind of background and characteristics of the people who tend to be most affected negatively by these products. And also, as always, we are, you know, keeping an eye on what's happening closer to home. So we've just published a recent investigation about the menthol cigarette ban in the EU, which is now 18 months in. We still can't say for certain what a menthol cigarette is. So it's actually a little bit farcical. If you look closely at the report, there's been a big kind of cache of documents published by Public Health England, and they are investigating what constitutes menthol cigarettes. So it's not a ban on any amount of menthol in cigarettes, but it's a ban on a characterizing flavor. And to work this out, the EU has employed a panel of human sniffers as part of the way of judging. Great, can't wait to see how that works. And I think what we have found is that 18 months on into this ban, you still can't say for sure, naughty, don't sell that product, it's got too much menthol in it. And actually, the big tobacco companies have been really helpful to the authorities because they're actually pointing out each other's products that may be, you know, exploiting loopholes in that ban. So that's been a very interesting investigation. And I think what it shows us is, you know, every challenge is an opportunity to big tobacco. And I think we're not going to stop looking, and we are very interested in the new stuff they're bringing out, their current products and their history. So basically the holistic approach to understanding. And as always, we're very open to tips and any kind of suggestions for things to investigate. And I think what's been lovely about Smokescreen actually is traditionally in kind of mainly written reporting and investigations, we wouldn't have been able to get that kind of real intimate, you know, in your ears, you're listening and it's happening around you thing that podcasts and audio really give you. And that's, as someone slightly to the outside of the podcast, it's been a real privilege to watch that unravel and become a thing that the Bureau's done. And obviously without people like Tom and, you know, the other companies involved, it would have been impossible. And I think what that shows us is, you know, there's lots to uncover that's new, and we're all always about what's new, what hasn't been told before, give us everything. Oh my goodness. Going back and looking, like Alex said, in a different way at an existing kind of issue, bringing it to a new audience or bringing up different aspects of it or from a different angle, and really prioritizing the narrative, the human, the characters, the plot. You know, we can actually, as journalists, sometimes do ourselves a disservice and be like, we're very careful about what we say. We give rights to reply. We reflect the truth. We don't go beyond what we know. But sometimes I think it can leave us a little bit, you know, less exciting and grabby and compelling as we might want to be. Some of us push, but some, you know, it's, and I think with audio, James is jumping in. Stop talking about the editor.
Yep. But thought I would say, I think Tom and the team at Novel have done a great job helping humanize the story. And also, you know, the team at Audi have been fantastic, both in terms of, we literally couldn't have done it without their support, but also promoting and putting it out and trying to make sure some people hear the story. But sort of there's one issue for the Bureau that I'm just going to ask you to touch on quickly, Chrissy, before I have a nice final sting of a question for Tom as we get to the close. But it's tricky for something like the Bureau that wants to make change with its journalism, but also gets funding from outside bodies to do it. And several tobacco companies have sort of pointed out to us that our funding is from Vital Strategies, which also funds anti-smoking campaign groups and is eventually sort of funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies. And Bloomberg himself is very much an anti-smoking, anti-vaping advocate. How much do you sort of find in your experience Vital tell us what to investigate or what our line is? And where do you think we draw the line in being journalists and not campaigners?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And, you know, the key to this is transparency. And, you know, I would just say, whatever journalism you're doing, whatever media you're making, unless you're extremely lucky to be patronized by some rich relative, you're always going to have to be funded by somewhere and someone, and that person is always going to have their biases, their interests, their positions, like any other humans. You know, but working at the Bureau and being around such kind of principled journalists and other staff there, we, you know, nobody would work in a situation where we were being told what to do. I mean, it's hard enough managing people in the Bureau, to be honest. You're not going to be able to tell them what to write either. Just a joke, love my team. So I think it, you know, Vital Strategies fund us, and we're very grateful for that support, among many other funders of the Bureau's wider work. You know, I've never once been told what to investigate, what not to investigate, you know, never been pointed at something. Occasionally we get an invitation to a press conference that's open to all other media, or we get, you know, there's an event that, you know, we probably knew about already because we're scanning the horizon for stuff like that, but there's absolutely no editorial involvement at all. And I think the line around kind of where do we draw the line is very interesting. So we actually have, on our team, we're very lucky to have an inbuilt, I was going to say, it makes them sound like a dishwasher, an impact producer who is embedded, that's what I meant, embedded within the team. So this impact producer will work with the reporters from the start of an investigation all the way through and beyond. Actually, when us editorial guys are like, we've published it, it's finished, although it never really is finished, our impact producer will think about who are the right audiences. So we'll work together at the start and be like, who needs to hear this? Who, you know, what will speak to them? Which audiences do we want? Which communities are affected? Where are the people that hold the power and the influence? If we want to help change happen, what is the right medium and the right audience and the right time and the right format to do this in? Now, that doesn't say that our impact producers sat there saying, do this story, do your reporting like this. You know, again, try telling a journalist to do their job in a way they don't want to do it. But what it does mean is that we are very aware from the start that we're not doing journalism for like the lulls or for the awards or for the recognition of our peers, even though all of those things are nice. We're not doing it to satisfy funders, although it's important that we obviously spend the money in the way, you know, we say we will. We're doing it to really, and this is going to sound very cheesy, but not only to kind of shed light, not heat, on the kind of wrongdoing in the world, and to try and, you know, give new life or new kind of attention to things that need attention. We're also trying to do things that can lead to positive change in the world. And in the global health team, obviously we've been very corona focused, but tobacco has always been a separate strand. And I think, you know, it will be, because it's just one of these massive health crises. It's a preventable, you know, cancers, heart disease, all of the things that come with smoking are preventable. You know, people are choosing to do this, albeit, you know, when you're addicted, it can be very hard to stop. You know, companies aren't, in my opinion, doing as much as they can to help people not be addicted. And really, they've got to kind of show the world that if they're serious about stopping cigarettes being such a fun and easy and enjoyable thing to do, then, you know, they need to step up the mark and do that. So everything we do ultimately is about uncovering the truth and holding power to account. But also, you know, we're going to do that in a way that hopefully has a positive impact in the world. Otherwise, why are we doing it? Just so my mum can say, well done. No.
Although, you know, we'd love to hear that anytime. But no, it really is.
Are you?
Stag on tobacco, when you look at it against coronavirus, since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, tobacco's killed roughly 14 million people across the world, which is a heck of a lot more people than coronavirus has killed. And quite rightly, coronavirus has topped headlines around the world. We've just got so desensitized to the impact of big tobacco. It's really shocking. I just feel like, just quickly before we finish, as we're wrapping up, I wanted to bring Tom in one more time, because you cannot do a big podcast like this making some very serious allegations against some quite, you know, prominent individuals and companies without spending a lot of time dealing with the Bureau's brilliant lawyer, Stephen Shotless. What is it like trying to legal something as complex and in some ways high risk as this, Tom?
Yeah, it's been a difficult process. And I mean, Stephen has been amazing to work with, and he has offered some very, very sage advice all the way through. I think what was particularly challenging with this is that this is a story that changes depending on who's telling it. And there is a lot of, you know, we have the documents and a very strong evidence base that allows us to be, you know, objective about what happened. But this is a story that also was experienced subjectively by a lot of people. And in podcasts, you've got a very, very long time for people to talk kind of candidly, but also informally about their experiences. And so somebody can say something that in the moment you're like, wow, that's such a zinger. It's definitely going to make it in. And then you take it to the lawyer and they go, no, there's no way that you can say that. So I think that that involved a lot of back and forth where, you know, having to accept, okay, actually, yeah, that wasn't quite right. And we can't quite say it in that way, but we're going to have to adapt it. And then other moments of sort of arguing back and saying, well, actually, I think here, if you understand in the context in which this person is saying this thing, what they're saying makes sense. And I think we can justify it on this basis. But it was definitely a process.
So
I just want to say big up to the fact checkers, because yeah. I know that's been everything we fact check at the Bureau and we think we're pretty good at it, but I think this was next level, you know, fact check. And like you say, when facts kind of change from person to person, that adds a little frisson of, oh my goodness. So yeah, I think the whole team has done, like I say, a brilliant job, and it has been a massive amount of work. And I think from, like I said, a slightly outsider's perspective, totally worth it. So.
Let's give our fact checker a name shout out, because it's Alice Milliken, who's fact checks pretty much every word you say, Victoria, or an interviewee say in that podcast, right down to if we call a building dilapidated, we have to show Alice a picture of that building.
Sorry, my favourite one was, is 12 o'clock lunchtime? Because you called that lunchtime. I think it's lunchtime. Sorry, she's brilliant. Love Alice and Frankie.
So Chrissy regards 12 o'clock to be lunchtime. But on that very important note, I'm going to thank... Oh, Alec looks like he wants to say something.
Yeah, there's a question here that's come through from Johan van Lochrenberg. Can I read it? And would you guys like to answer it? It says, bribery, corruption as a crime, as well as money laundering as a crime, aren't bound by jurisdictional restrictions. I understand the focus and hope placed on the SFO, but why are none of you asking questions about what other law enforcement agencies and regulators in the UK, Zimbabwe, and South Africa are doing, or rather not doing? They have, as a fact, better access and more powers to access evidence and witnesses, and I know they have more evidence than the podcast demonstrated. Why the apathy? Is BAT that powerful and untouchable? And what about the role of law firms and audit firms, for example, Norton Rose Fulbright and KPMG in this saga? Thought I had to bring that up because he's written it there.
I think it's a very good set of questions. It looks like Victoria would like to jump in too, but I'll sort of say, I know that we have, as part of our impact work, been trying to reach out to a few other international investigatory agencies, not actually just in those areas. And we actually have a piece coming somewhat on actually quite SFO focused, because we are a London-based organisation and that's where we have the best connections and sway. But no, I think these are very good questions to ask. But I do think Johan slightly answered his own question as well, where he talks about BAT's sway. But Victoria looks like she wanted to jump in there.
No, I was just going to say that it speaks to the huge frustration that we've all had through this. Norton Rose Fulbright had published an report. They'd done a preliminary report into BAT's activities in South Africa back in 2016-17, I think it was. And it's never been made public. I mean, it's deeply frustrating. If they investigated and found no evidence of wrongdoing, why not make that public? You think they'd be very proud to put that out there. You know, their defense is it's a private company done in a private capacity. But yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out a way to force that into the light, and you know, with limited, obviously no success. And there was an investigation by the police started in the UK, but again, closed. You know, a lot just comes down to things like that unsigned affidavit, Belinda not going through with talking to the authorities. And just we spoke to some of the people that were on that initial police investigation, and it was like, and they were, you know, casting their mind back. Oh, I think it just petered out. And, you know, we can only go so far. And I think that the way that we've kept our focus on the SFO, because they are the UK authority responsible for prosecutions that come under the Bribery Act. And, you know, that's been our focus, but absolutely valid question by JVL. And sadly, I can't give a better answer than that. But just, yeah, it's not over.
So, no, well, we will see and hope that more happens. But I will wrap us up here. I will say, if you haven't listened to the podcast, please do. It is Smokescreen, and it is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you have listened to it and enjoyed it, please do leave a 5-star review on the Apple Store. It really helps more people to find it and see it. And we currently have a very good rating on the UK store in particular. So thank you for that. I'd like to thank Alec, Victoria, Tom and Chrissy for joining us. And everyone who's listened to this, thank you very much for joining us.
If you've been enjoying Smokescreen, please don't forget to like, comment and share this podcast. Apparently, it helps other people hear about it. Thank you.